You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team, every day.
Man, I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible. Oh, my mama. Oh, my mama made it, man. Anything's possible.
Rainy days, jump shot, fade away. This the best Celtics podcast day to day. I get excited about it like when Tatum play a Jalen on the breakaway, or Kyrie when he make a trade. And nothing like the terrible analysts on the TV. So in depth that after you play it, you gotta repeat. So in depth they might do an hour about the D-League. So in depth you probably should pay him, but it's a freebie. Yeah, Corrales, Packard, and J. King. Locked on, trying to get the 18th ring. And well wishes go to Gordon. Listen, after every game, it's very important, Millie.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Locked On Celtics podcast with the Rainy Jays. And today it's me, your boy Jay King from The Athletic, here with Sam Jam Packard, the great formerly of WEI. We're going to do a little rehashing of Boston's Game 1 blowout win. The Cavs, considering a lineup change, considering bringing Tristan Thompson into the equation, going to a bigger lineup to have a better chance of defending Al Horford. And a couple of things the internet has gone wild about: LeBron James's impressive memory, and then something that's just really stupid. Who deserves more credit for the Celtics season? Brad Stevens, the Celtics players. Who gets the credit? We'll discuss that later in this podcast. Let's start off with the Tristan Thompson possibility, because that's real basketball, Sam. And let's start with real basketball. So basically, Ty Lue said he's looked at potentially, or he will look at potentially starting Tristan Thompson. Tristan Thompson has historically done a really good job limiting Al Horford. Tristan Thompson has historically bashed the Celtics on the offensive glass. Tristan Thompson would theoretically help to shore up a Cavaliers defense that allowed 60 points in the paint in Game 1. Sam, if the Cavaliers do go to Tristan Thompson, should the Celtics stick with their starting line with Marcus Morris in it, or go back to Baines at the 5?
I expect them to match Baines with Thompson. I just think their defense, at least in the regular season, with Baines on the court, was using some of their best lineups, and I just think they're going to match size for size. That being said, for the Celtics to be most effective, they have to be playing Al Horford at the 5. That's just like what allows their offense to click. So there's certainly going to be minutes where it's Thompson on Horford. I don't expect like them to ever play a closing lineup with Aaron Baines. So I wouldn't like change it up that much if I was the Celtics. I think they play pretty solid defense with Horford at the 5. They played a phenomenal defense in Game 1. I don't know. I just don't think we're going to see if Tristan Thompson can do what he's historically done against Al Horford. He didn't really do much in Game 1. He had a couple boards and some points during his first stint, but then he wasn't. Just because the Cavs were so far out of the game, he wasn't that impressive in the second half. So we'll see. I don't know. I don't think the Celtics will change more or change their starting lineup or change the minutes, really. Maybe you'll probably end up with more minutes for Baines, but I don't think it's a huge thing. Al Horford just has to be better than Tristan Thompson, which is what everyone worried me about the game about, or at least Justin Rowan said Tristan Thompson was going to dominate this game, and that's why the Cavs are going to win. He didn't do much in Game 1. I still think Al Horford is a better player and playing so like phenomenally right now. I don't think it will have that much of an impact. I think this series really comes down to LeBron James playing better, not necessarily Tristan Thompson.
Yeah, I think I have a few thoughts about this. One, Tristan Thompson, he really has done a good job on Al Horford in the past.
Like, oh yeah, he's really like thoroughly dominated him.
Yeah, so Tristan's done a great job on Al Horford in the past. This is not the same Al Horford.
Also not the same Tristan Thompson. He's like not as explosive and has been shitty this entire year.
Yeah, so I think they're playing at totally different levels than they have in the past. And especially, like, Horford has just been ridiculous this postseason. It hasn't really mattered who's guarding him. Hasn't really mattered which team he's been playing. He's just been really good, really consistently. He's done it inside with an absurd conversion rate on post-ups. He's done it outside, stretching teams out. He forced the 76ers to switch Joel Embiid onto somebody else. Like, Horford has just been destroying guys this whole postseason, just playing great basketball. So, to me, it's going to be fascinating to see what Brad does, whether he wants to match up big for big with Baines and Thompson, or just say, you know what? Screw it. If they take one of the shooters out of the lineup, either J.R. Smith or Kyle Korver, which would be, I think, the obvious move if they do change up their starting lineup, he might say, you know what? We can guard these guys anyway. We don't need Baines in there to guard these guys because we'll still have a lot of guys to guard LeBron. They won't have as many shooting threats around him. And yes, Tristan Thompson's a bear on the offensive glass, but you'll live with a couple offensive rebounds if you can guard everybody else. And then at the other end, score the basketball, because this Celtics small lineup, I don't know if people realize how good they've been scoring the basketball. The Marcus Morris, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum trio is tops among all postseason trios with a 125.2 offensive rating this postseason. And that's among trios with at least 75 minutes played. So it's, I forget, it was like seven pages on NBA.com. So seven times 25, however many that is, they were the top trio of all of them. And yes, the Celtics had real trouble scoring during the season. They found ways to manufacture points. And so Brad will have an interesting decision to whether he just wants to see how the defense holds up and just score against the Cavaliers defense that will still have some issues, or whether he wants to go big, match up Baines with Thompson, and do it that way. So,
well, that's the thing. He has the flexibility to do both and see kind of firsthand what he thinks is working and what he thinks is the best solution. I think there's advantages to each of them. Like, the Cavaliers taking one of their three-point shooters off the court just doesn't sound like a good idea for them. I mean, they really struggled from downtown in game one. They were, opened up 0 for 10, 0 for 12? Like, does taking J.R. Smith off the court really make their offense more dynamic? I think the Celtics will live with, if they want to do a bunch of posting up with Thompson or, like, I guess just interior shots, the Celtics, they play such tough defense that they'll kind of, I think, live with that, especially with Baines on the court. But you're right, the small lineup has been when they're scoring the most points. And that being said, they're playing pretty well defensively in that small lineup. The thing that's crazy is they're really attacking mismatches when the Cavs are switching everything. And so it'd be interesting to see the dynamic of how that changes when, if they bring in Tristan Thompson, are they going to be switching every pick and roll with Tristan Thompson, or are they going to be playing more of a traditional pick and roll defense that way? I don't know how much that changes, but and how much of switching they did with Thompson in the regular season. But I think it also changes things on the defensive end or offensive end. But I think Al Horford just took out Joel Embiid. Joel Embiid is just like a better player than Tristan Thompson all around. I think Al Horford can hold his own pretty much against any center in the league. I know historically Thompson has it, but I don't know how you watch what Al Horford's done this season. And, like, I don't know. I'm guessing maybe it's recency bias, but I have a belief in Horford. And I'm a huge homer, so too.
Thompson moves his feet better, I think, and is among the best offensive rebounders in the league. When he's right, he's just an absolute problem on the glass, and you have to spend so much effort tracking LeBron that he just gets open. So Thompson can be a real problem. Whether that's enough to force Brad to switch his lineup, I'm not sure. I guess we'll see. And
do you think the offense is good enough with Baines in there? Like, do you think the Celtics can score enough if Baines is getting a lot of minutes to kind of match the size of Thompson?
Maybe.
You still have Kevin Love, and who's Kevin? Like, you can still attack Kevin Love and pick and roll in that situation, who's been pretty bad. It was pretty bad in game one and really lost. I guess he lost Al Horford. That's the thing, is they would put Thompson on Horford and Kevin Love on Aaron Baines. And there was one Aaron Baines, Kevin Love post up in game one, and it didn't really go that well. Baines not known for his post game.
Baines certainly not known for his post game. Probably not the best offense to find him, especially I think when he was posting up, it was
he's got to get to the corner and shoot corner threes, man. Really stretch him out. Play five out with Baines. It makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, five out. Aaron Baines just flinging him.
It worked against the Sixers, man.
The one thing that was funny about Game 1 is, like, the Raptor series, the Cavaliers looked like they got their mojo back. Like, they just waxed the Raptors. They scored at will. They did whatever they wanted. And then the Celtics come in. And when you think about it, it's really kind of not stunning, but certainly surprising and certainly a role switch that it's the Cavaliers who are thinking about a lineup switch against the Celtics. It's always been the Celtics scrambling to keep up in the matchups. But they had their way in Game 1. And I think we're seeing more as these playoffs go along that the Celtics cause a lot of matchup problems. And I think part of it is just the teams that they've played, they've matched up pretty well against. But part of it is just that Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Terry Rozier, their speed, their shooting, and their ability to beat one-on-one defense has really given teams fits, from Marco Bellinelli to J.J. Redick to, you know, Eric Bledsoe in the first round. And in Game 1, it was Kyle Korver and Jordan Clarkson. And
sure, just name all the white players, man. I'm just talking about all the white guys.
I just said Jordan Clarkson, bro.
Yeah, but and you said Eric Bledsoe, so I don't know what I was talking about. I just wanted to get a joke off.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. It was a good joke. There were a lot of white guys in there.
It wasn't great.
But they're problems. And I don't know if I realized how difficult matchup-wise they were going to be to defend against going into the postseason. But those guys, when you have all of them out there, it's tough to match up with every single one. And then Marcus Morris, when he's going right as he was in Game 1, he can be a low post threat against smaller guys. He can space the floor shooting threes. And when he's playing with the starting lineup, Marcus Morris tends to take better shots, like spot-up threes, rather than his godly ISO Mook mid-range shots. So that, I think that's a little bit different when he plays with the better players in the first unit. I forget where I was here, but I was just trying to say that the Celtics are scoring more points than I thought they would during the postseason.
It's a good point because the offense is really playing much better, and I think Jaylen Brown and Tatum's just ability to beat guys off the dribble has been key, and Jaylen Brown's really done a good job of attacking. I think Jaylen Brown is at his best when he's really doing it, like trying to get to the rim. I think it drives like everything when he plays earlier, gets to the rim earlier in the game. He's more confident, he's pretty confident with the 3-point shot as is right now. He's been taking it with ease recently, but I think that's working for him. But you're right, and then you throw in the chaos that is Marcus Smart on all of that, who is also an able pick and roll ball handler and can create offense that way. Is one probably the Celtics' best playmaker after Al Horford, and when they play pick and roll together, it's magnificent. You get lobs for days. So you throw in that as like your sixth man. I think the Celtics' offense has been, it's been better in just the execution, and they're doing a really good job of attacking mismatches. And so if a team switches constantly, they kind of have an answer for that. And then they still have the kind of, if a team's not switching, playing more like traditional pick and roll defense, they have the kind of the motion offense available to them to get shots. So I don't know if it's just playoff execution or they're like shortening their line. They have certainly shortened the lineup, and so there's less of those really terrible second unit lineups.
Yep.
That kind of plagued the Celtics. And so that definitely has something to do with it. But you're right. They've been quite good. And in Game 1, especially in the first quarter, they were phenomenal.
Yeah, and they really have. They've been tough to stop. Now, will they always be that tough to stop against Cleveland? I don't know. Cleveland, it was very similar to the first game of the Pacers series. I thought J.R. Smith said something interesting in the post-game locker room. J.R. Smith was like, that's a different vibe than the Pacers blowout loss. He's like, Celtics have more guys who can catch and shoot. Celtics have more guys who can put it on the floor. It just felt different to J.R. Smith. So I think that's a nod to how well the Celtics are playing and how many threats they have on the court at all times. It's this run has just been really impressive. It's just like it really is. It's kind of laughable at this point. Like, they just seem to be getting better and better as the playoffs progress. They won 4 out of 5 against the Sixers, and their 3-point defense has just been ridiculous, starting with the Sixers series.
Jason Tatum, when he runs people off the line, he doesn't care at all. He sells out completely. Like, there are some couple times Jason Tatum's just going. He goes. He has one track mind. He's closing that guy out and not letting him take a three, and it's awesome.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of people focused on the Cavaliers missing open shots, and I certainly think there was some of that. But I think one of the most important stats for the Celtics over the last two series is how much they've limited actual 3-point attempts. It's not just the teams are shooting poorly against them. I mean, the Sixers in the second round were the worst 3-point shooting team in the second round. I think they did shoot about 30% from the arc. But they also didn't attempt nearly as many threes as they did all season. And the Celtics were selling out to stop those guys from shooting threes alongside Simmons. And then you saw the same mindset carry over to the Cavs game. And I know the Cavaliers missed a lot of shots. They only got 26 threes. If you're only shooting 26 threes, then and you're only scoring, I believe it was 38 points in the paint, you're not scoring a lot. You're not getting a lot of good looks. So Celtics defense has been unbelievable. We've talked all along about the switchiness, and it just comes into play because not only can they switch and keep their defense intact, but then you switch Jaylen Brown onto Kevin Love in the post, and maybe it's not even a mismatch. You know, like Love tried to post up Brown, and Brown just jumped up and swatted that bitch away.
And then if they put this is something Zach Lowe was talking about on his podcast today about if you put Marcus Smart in for Terry Rozier in that small lineup, that team can legitimately switch 1 through 5. And you trust Marcus Smart in the post in post defense against anyone in the league, which is kind of insane. But you welcome it. Anytime there's a one-on-one matchup with Marcus Smart in the post, you just know he's such a bully that you just kind of welcome that scenario. You just don't want to post Marcus Smart up, and he's been doing a pretty good job of playing out of the post and attacking the switches on the other end.
Yeah. The one thing I will say about Marcus Smart switching all five positions is, yes, you can do that. In the past, LeBron has been one of the few guys who can give him fits.
And yeah, he's LeBron James. That
yes.
makes sense.
Yes, yes. But Smart did pick his pocket in game one. But I don't think that's something the Celtics should be comfortable with. I think in game one, their switches on the fly were just so impressive. There were a couple times like they switched after the entry pass was thrown so that instead of having Rozier on LeBron, they'd have Tatum or Jaylen Brown or Marcus Morris or Al Horford. And it was like, wow, these guys, their defensive communication, obviously I sit, you know, 20 rows up, whatever it is, and I can't hear what's going on in the court. Their defensive communication must be so good to be able to switch on the fly like they do and scramble and recover and still not give up open shots. I think if there's one thing the Cavaliers will try to exploit in game two, it will be finding a way to beat those switches, whether it's finding cuts on the weak side or whatever the case may be. They're going to try to find something so that the Celtics can't be just switching on the fly and disrupting things like that. But there were just a lot of arms, a lot of long arms in LeBron's way in the passing lanes and everything else. And that's one of the worst postseason games LeBron's played in a long time, I'd be willing to wager.
That's the thing, is that you have to expect LeBron, after his feel-out game, he felt everything out,
yep,
to come out with a more aggressive game two, and just because he was passive. That was the wild thing. It wasn't just he was bad with the turnovers or like making poor decisions or not even like hustling back on defense. It's just he didn't seem very aggressive in trying to attack. And so you have to imagine there's going to be a more aggressive LeBron in game two, and maybe that is – him attacking players like Terry Rozier and Marcus Smart in the post if they do try and switch and attacking them earlier. You're right, the Cavs, like, they're kind of taking a while to get, like, once the switch happened, trying to attack the mismatch, allowing the Celtics to do kind of switches on the fly like that. But you have to imagine LeBron comes out in game two just a lot more aggressive. And that's, like, that's kind of the unknown factor. It feels like the Celtics are a better team and are playing as a better team at this point, but you just don't know. It's like, when is LeBron going to come out and play, like, the best player in the series card? Because if it just turns into a game of LeBron just, like, abusing the Celtics in the post, they'll probably have to change up their switching and that kind of, I don't know. You just, there's this, until LeBron is officially gone, there's just an utter fear of LeBron because I think he's quite good at basketball.
Yeah, he's pretty good, man. He is pretty good. And the Celtics are uniquely equipped to try stop slowing him down.
They have the second best guy in stopping him in the league, in Marcus Morris.
Yeah,
I don't want to defend Marcus Morris. He got a lot of crap for talking a bunch of shit, and like nationally, I like listened to other podcasts and seen on Twitter, and everyone's like, "Oh, is Marcus Morris like backing that talk up?" But I watched like the clip of that from practice, and it was like just a completely generic answer. He was just like, "LeBron's great, but I'm confident in my abilities," and he just got blown up with like, "Oh, Marcus Morris talking again." It's like, no, that's just like a generic answer from a basketball player. So I thought that was like a weird narrative take on that.
That was probably partly my fault. I didn't realize how much people were gonna react to the quote about him talking about Kawhi, and then people got wild over that quote with him saying he thinks he's the best LeBron defender outside of Kawhi. And I just thought it was like he was just being confident in his own abilities. He obviously respects what LeBron does. I just thought it was notable. And then people were like thinking it's bulletin board material, thinking that he was disrespecting LeBron James. Like, no. The guy said he's going to tell his kids about this matchup, that he played LeBron in the playoffs. Like, he is not at all trying to disrespect LeBron James. Morris has called LeBron the best player in the game, like, I don't know how many times since the series was set, he just embraces the challenge. So I think that was my fault and the fault of the Celtics writers. If I knew how much backlash there was going to be, I would have included the other part of the quote on that first tweet, and I assume some of the other guys would have probably done the same. My bad, yo. My bad.
All right, so here's a question. Were you a member of the Boston media who clapped for LeBron James after he recounted the first couple plays of the fourth quarter?
No.
Did you clap for him?
No, I did not clap for LeBron James. No. First of all, I'm not going to clap in a damn press conference. That was – whoever clapped was foolish. And my man Michael Pena, I love Michael Pena. I think he tweeted something like he will –
Are you saying he clapped?
No, he said he will forever regret not clapping. Like – I love you, Pena.
No, any sense.
I love you, Pena, but nah, just chill. So again,
were you impressed by his memory, though?
So two things. Yes, it's cool that he can remember so vividly all those plays. I don't think it's like a unique thing to him. I think there aren't. It's not every guy in the NBA that can do it. That's certainly not the case. Like, there are some guys who probably forget half the game, or at least the details as LeBron remembered them as soon as the game ends. But I also think, like, with a lot of the best players, the intellect it takes to be so good, you remember stuff like that. And especially 10 minutes after the game, it's not like he was recalling a game that happened 5 years ago. It was like he was less than an hour after the game and recalling plays. So, yeah, it was cool that he did it, and it was cool that he knew every play, but I just don't think he's the only one who could do that. So, I
think if you ask Brad after any game to be like, what, like, give us the play-by-play of this quarter, he could do it. I just think if it's something that maybe it's like a self-selecting thing if you're really good at like spatial memory and things like that you're better at basketball. But I think a lot of like people who watch the game and people who are like very invested in the game kind of have memories like that. They're used to breaking down like film constantly, where it's just everything like play is kind of segmented by play, and it's like log video and stuff like that. I don't know. I just think it's kind of like that's the way like a basketball mind kind of works. And I wish I was like could remember that much, but I also feel like me and you kind of do that, or me and John do that on the podcast. Not to the extent that like LeBron did, but like the common fan, if you're paying attention, can remember like four consecutive possessions. Like that is not the biggest thing in the world. Me and John talked about it on the podcast, and I didn't have the level of detail of LeBron, but I noted that stretch as like an important run, and there was three offensive plays to it. So
all,
I don't know.
All hail King Packard.
I mean, if I didn't like smirk afterwards like LeBron did in his press conference, like he was like a golden god. Well, it was kind of a dick way to answer the question, but I guess the lady has to ask a better question next time. She did ask what happened at the start of the fourth quarter, so well played, LeBron. Touche.
I mean, he did respond with exactly what happened at the start of the fourth quarter. He failed to mention
that he had a turnover during that stretch. He just mentioned it. He called it as a missed basket, but he just threw a terrible pass. And so I think he didn't mention that, and he got Jordan Crawford's name wrong.
Yeah, that
Jordan Clarkson.
That was
his name is.
That was kind of hilarious because it was like he was recounting every detail and then just forgot his own teammate's name.
I think it was intentional because he was angry at Jordan Crawford for being terrible. Damn it, Clarkson.
That could be true.
That was two times in a row where I just made that mistake completely unintentionally.
Yeah. The other thing we want to talk about, who deserves the praise? The Celtics players or Brad Stevens? I don't know why this has become a topic on Twitter. And people are getting...
Because it's NBA Twitter, man. We need something to talk about on an off day.
People are getting heated about this topic.
Well, yeah. It's a lot of it is fans who play for Eastern Conference teams, and I'm focusing most of my attention towards very upset Raptors fans and less upset 76ers fans. But people are getting a very, very sensitive about either Brad Stevens or and I guess receiving too much credit because he hasn't won anything yet, or the players are better than. It's all just crazy, like reflections on like the narrative and whether or not the Celtics should be expected to be here because of Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving injuries like that, or whether or not their players are talented.
Yeah.
And it feels like a weird choice that you're forced to make where it's like, no, the Celtics have a lot of talented players, but they also have a very good coach in Brad Stevens. And like both of those are the reason why they're playing well. And it feels weird to have to choose or assign more credit to each one, or it's like, we really have no way of figuring that out. I'm guessing it's the players is the reason why the Celtics are winning games, but the fact that Brad Stevens is there definitely helps. And so like, if you're unwilling to say both of those statements, it just seems like, well, why are we having this conversation? Like, why can't you appreciate that both can be true?
Yeah, so my thoughts are this. It's definitely weird that Brad gets as much credit as he does. There aren't a lot of coaches who get credit like he does to the point where it clouds the accomplishments of his players. And I do think Brad Stevens is an elite NBA coach. I think he's up there among the best. I think he might be the very best. I think in a playoff series, he can be a real advantage. But when you look at like Ty Lue, the Cavaliers just roasted the Raptors, just dominated them, and Ty Lue received no credit. And part of that is just because he has LeBron on his team, and LeBron's always going to receive the credit when his team dominates somebody. But there's also a dichotomy of how Brad Stevens gets respect versus how other coaches do. And maybe Brad deserves all of that, but I also do think it clouds the level of talent, or it overshadows the level of talent on the Celtics roster. Yes, they lost Kyrie Irving. Yes, they lost Gordon Hayward. Well, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum give teams hell. And Terry Rozier is a defending, rebounding, hot shooting guard who's averaging close to 20 points throughout the playoffs. And Al Horford is a great defender, versatile defender, who can stretch to the three-point arc and beat closeouts and make great plays. And Marcus Morris is a rugged guy who's 6'9 and 240 pounds and uniquely equipped to compete with a guy like LeBron James because of his size and mobility and toughness. And so I do think when you look at the Celtics roster, they still have a large talent level. It's not like this is a talent-devoid team. And I think part of that is the injuries, and then part of it is the credit. A lot of the credit goes to Brad Stevens, and he's been great. He's been fantastic. Some of his ATOs.
He hates compliments, man. He is uncomfortable with any praise.
The praise.
What was the quote today?
The praise is uncomfortable.
That's a classic Brad Stevens quote. He hates any time there's an attention on him. And I think it's like it's kind of ironic that how much like the disproportionate amount of praise he gets versus like how much he really hates it. Like he would want the praise to be on the players. But you like you said, it's kind of crazy how much praise he gets, and then you listed all the like reasons why you think he's probably one of the best coaches in the league. Like he's done nothing but have like success, and just because he hasn't won yet, I don't think we should like recognize that he's not a very good coach. And that's the thing, you mentioned all the players, and they are quite talented, but we have no way of knowing what the effect of Brad Stevens is. We just kind of imagine that it's positive, and there are certain ways we can see that. But there's really no like counterfactual. We can't see this team coached by another coach and like see how they were perform. And so there's no like real way to discern who has an impact. It's both true. Both things are true.
But like,
have a lot of talent, and Brad is quite good.
Yeah, like let's put it this way. If Kristaps Porzingis takes a leap next year, will Fizdale get all the credit, or will people just be like, "Oh, Kristaps came back from his ACL injury and he's looking better than ever." Like most of the credit will probably go to Porzingis. And I do think Brad has helped all the young guys. Like the fact that they're this young and this capable in the playoffs is ridiculous. It's absurd. And Brad deserves a lot of credit. Like I said, he's one of the best coaches. Absolutely. Maybe the very best coach. But it does sometimes feel weird to me that not enough credit goes to the players for what they do. And Brad in some ways is the Celtics' biggest star. I'm
the biggest Brad stan there is, and I'd have to, like, is he a star? I guess he gets a lot of the credit on basketball, but I don't know. I do give him credit for the young players playing well. I mean, mostly because...
he's a great coach.
But it's also because of, like, the growth mindset type things and the specific things he's trying to implement in the players of that. We talk about how the Celtics young players are not afraid of the moment and have always, like, believe, and the Celtics team specifically is really great at like coming back from adversity or like being very tough in the moment, and I think that is like kind of follows the personality or like what Brad Stevens wants to instill. And so admittedly I'm a Brad stan, and I'd say I'm in like and say Kaizen way too much, and I'm also in the cult of Brad Stevens. So I don't know, I think the players should just get way more of the credit always. Like they're the ones on the court making the decisions, making the plays. But I don't know. There's no answer because there's no way to measure how good of coaching is. I just know a good coach when I see one, and Brad Stevens is quite good.
My final very hot take on this is that
this is why Twitter exploded today, because it's like an interesting conversation to have, and we need more we got to be constantly churning out content.
Well, I mean, we've had this conversation and we both agree. Like, my final hot take on this.
That's all Twitter is people agree.
My final hot take on this is the Celtics have a great coach and great players. Boom.
Hey, now. I would say they have a great organizational culture as well, a great GM, great ownership, great daily Celtics coverage from a podcast form, at least in my opinion.
That would be the Locked On Celtics podcast. If you don't subscribe to us already, you're stupid. But you can do so by searching for Locked On Celtics in iTunes, Spotify, wherever else you get your podcasts. We are the only Monday through Friday Celtics podcast. We are the greatest Celtics podcast ever, and we are done with this episode.
Yeah, Jay King and John Corrales, Locked On Celtics.